He gave you a feeling that you were listening not to a man, but to a force, or something big and impersonal like that, to a long-pent primordial force suddenly breaking through. Because he had Tojo's backing and had once headed the Indian National Congress, Bose possessed a clout and credibility that no other exiled nationalist had ever enjoyed. He also had the money and the influence to deliver the rice that he was promising for Bengal. British authorities resolved, however, to treat the offer as if it were propaganda. They recognized that since his arrival in Southeast Asia, the rebel had become more potent, and we are, of course, particularly anxious to discredit Subhas Bose in every possible way, wrote a senior official. Censors ensured that no mention of his offer appeared in the press. The British must have thought his offer was genuine, opined historian Sugata Bose and grand-nephew of Subhas Bose in an interview. If they really thought it was a bluff, they would have called it. Had the leader failed to keep his promise, he would have been destroyed as a political force. When it came to a question of Bengalis starving to death, Subhas Chandra Bose would not have engaged in a propaganda stunt, Sugata Bose added. When you look at his life, he was engaged in social work, plague relief and flood relief since childhood. The War Cabinet knew of Bose's rice offer, having received at least one of the pertinent intelligence summaries, but whether or not the issue was discussed is unclear. Although ships capable of traversing the oceans were scarce, hundreds of smaller vessels were plying along the Indian coast, most of them under government control. The proximity of Calcutta to Rangoon or other Burmese ports meant that Bose's rice could have arrived within a week or two had the authorities chosen to collect it. Distributed at the rate of a half kilogram per person per day, 100,000 tons would have fed 1.6 million people for 4 months, after which Bengalis would be harvesting their own winter crop. To be sure, Subhas Chandra Bose was a despised enemy of the United Kingdom. He was an Axis collaborator and a target of British assassins. But when occupied Greece underwent famine in the winter of late 1941, Germany had permitted humanitarian agencies, such as the International Red Cross, to bring in relief and distribute it, a remarkable instance of Axis-Allied cooperation during the war. When it came to Bengal, His Majesty's government would turn down even those offers of cereals that came not from adversaries but from friends. The dominions of Australia, South Africa, New Zealand and Canada all asked how they could help. Australia could supply all the wheat needed for the starving in India, provided the United Kingdom could provide the ships, stated a minister in Canberra, as reported by Reuters on September 28. Wheat was practically waiting to be loaded on boats. Virtually all Dominion shipping was under the War Cabinet's control, as were 17 merchant ships registered in India, amounting to around 80,000 gross tons that were capable of the journey to Australia. Almost all our ships had been taken away, Sir J.P. Srivastava later told the Famine Commission. Srivastava was the member of the Viceroy's Executive Council who was responsible for food. At one time I asked whether these ships could not be released to us to carry food grains, but nothing came of it. As a result, only highly compact foods could be loaded onto the ships that were already destined for India from the Empire's ports. Amory informed the New Zealand government, which had authorized £10,000 of famine relief, that a free gift of powdered or condensed milk to this value would be the most useful form of gift, as shipping could be most easily arranged for that. Ireland sent £100,000, and Prime Minister Eamon de Valera asked his compatriots for more. Meanwhile, the leader of the country's Labour Party reminded the Irish people that when their forefathers had starved under British rule in the previous century, Indians had sent help. Private charities in the United Kingdom and the United States also began to collect money. The Red Cross started operations in Calcutta, but it could provide only milk powder, vitamins and medicines. These were valuable, but no substitute for rice or wheat. Dukarahan Thakur Chakrabarti, a 16-year-old who lived near Howrah, once went with a group of communist medical students who were distributing powdered milk and medicines they had obtained from the Red Cross. In a neighbouring village, the teenager saw row after row of disintegrating huts, some missing their tin roofs, which the owners had pawned for food before abandoning them. Hearing sounds from within one hut, the students knocked. A tiny girl opened the door. Dukarahan looked in and saw her father lying on a reed mat on the mud floor. He was sick and moaned in a continuous refrain, "Ore ami a banshbo nare," meaning, "I won't live any longer." The girl said her mother had gone somewhere and started crying. "We gave them some milk and medicines. Couldn't do much else," Chakrabarti recalled. Another time, the teenager was about to cross a busy street near the railway station in Howrah when he saw a truck full of men come to a stop on the far side of the road. They began to grab people from the pavement and throw them onto the truck. I didn't know who they were, but they were merciless. They were catching hold of old men, beggars, anyone they could grab. They picked up a girl of perhaps 15. Her sari fell off, and I saw that she was naked under it, nothing on her but the ring in her nose. "Hau mau kore kanchi," she was howling desperately. I stood rooted to the spot. It was the first time Chakrabarti had seen a naked female, and the vision never left him. I still wonder, where did they take her? What happened to her? "I wish I had run forward, protested, done something to help her," he said 60 years later, "but I just stood there." The truck was from a government program to cleanse Calcutta's streets. Near the end of August, Governor Herbert had come down with an inflamed ulcer and appendix. Shortly afterward, Chief Minister Nazimuddin summoned civil servant Olaf Martin to Calcutta and asked him to take charge of the relief operation. Martin had run such programs in 1936, but that year he'd started work in January and had found that this was not a day too soon, Martin commented in his memoir. Here was a much bigger calamity. Eventually it dawned on the civil servant that his job was not so much to begin gruel kitchens or work for food programs in the countryside, for which there was not enough grain, as to rid the city of unsightly beggars as quietly as possible. The army was demanding this and had the support of the viceroy. It was a matter of morale, Calcutta being the place where soldiers billeted in the east went for recreation. With the help of politician Shyama Prasad Mukherjee, Martin rented space for relief centres just outside the city. But the refugees took to hiding when they spied the trucks that went around to collect them, because most of them were waiting for relatives who had gone in search of food. They had to be chased, grabbed, and thrown onto the trucks. The cleansing of Calcutta broke up many families, and although Martin would eventually set up a camp where those with missing relatives could go and search for lost family members, the problem of involuntary separation was never solved. Years later, the writer Mahasweta Devi would employ a maid named Hiron, who spent much of her time crying because during the famine she had left her daughter on the pavement to go search for food and never saw her again. It was also routine to see dead people being picked up in government trucks, tossed in like logs, Devi recalled. Thok, thok, they would land, as if made of wood. I heard they were burned in furnaces of factories, serving the war as fuel. Manos Banerjee, a 17-year-old student, had been jailed for participating in the Quit India movement. After his release in the summer of 1943, he arrived in Calcutta to find beggars and corpses everywhere. Dumped in a crater excavated for the construction of a movie theatre were dozens of corpses that filled the environs with a horrific stench. Some months later, as he marched in a protest to the governor's palace, shouting slogans against the famine, communist thugs armed with lathis fell upon them from both sides. "A comrade got my friend by the throat and was choking him," said Banerjee. "I gave him a blow, then we ran." A few of the demonstrators managed to break through the palace gate, but came under police fire or were arrested. Communists initially supported the Axis, but had switched sides after Germany attacked the Soviet Union in 1941. Because Stalin and Churchill combined, that is fundamental, one Bolshevik would explain to the Famine Commission. Churchill, as a comrade in arms, is completely different from Churchill in opposition. Thereafter, the Communist Party of India declared that it was fighting a people's war against fascism and began to actively support the authorities. Communists were prominent among the intellectuals who chronicled the famine in art and literature, but they placed all blame for it on speculators and the Japanese. Consequently, they stayed out of jail, prevented food stocks from being looted, suppressed protests, helped distribute whatever relief was available, and acquired political leverage in Bengal. The police were fully engaged in hunting down political subversives. At one point, the teenage courier, Kanu Mahapatro, realized that either the police or the intelligence bureau had posted men to watch the building in North Calcutta, where he had stashed copies of Biplabi. The printed sheets were secreted in a room rented by Congress volunteers from Burdwan district, north of Midnapore. Fearing that a search was in the offing, Kanu decided to stage a move. Along with a friend, he approached two streetwalkers and asked them to pose with him as family. The rebels from Burdwan provided pots, pans, brooms, pillows, and other household items. These Kanu piled onto a cart with the newsletters hidden in a bedroll at the bottom. Acting the roles of a householder, his wife, and his younger brother and sister, he and the others talked and cursed volubly about water supply and other domestic matters as they pushed the cart past the watchman. When far enough away, Kanu decided to stop and let the women go, and they asked what it had all been about. When we explained who we were, they were in tears, so thrilled were they at having been able to help, Mahapatro said. They would have fallen at our feet if we'd let them. They wouldn't take any money. The police had been overwhelmed by duties related to war and insurgency for more than a year, as Deputy Inspector General C.J. Minister of the Criminal Investigation Department would tell the Famine Commission. To begin with, he said, from early 1942 onward, the police had had to help implement the rice denial policy, which required grain to be forcibly requisitioned from landowners and cultivators. Eventually, criminals had come to realize that they had a much greater opportunity than they had had before. Armed robbery had skyrocketed, he continued, the reason being the steady relaxation of police surveillance over known criminals. After that, the Quit India movement had inevitably absorbed the whole attention of the police, who had no time left to take notice of anything else. The Tamluk insurgency had proved particularly onerous. On top of that, many convicts had reportedly been released from prison. The authorities remained absorbed in curbing the activities of their political adversaries, while marauders, war profiteers, child traffickers and hucksters of all kinds roamed free. Bengali society had descended into Matsyayana, defined as a time when big fish ate little fish. A madam named Durga made her fortune at the famine time. A ravishing beauty, tall and very fair of skin, she used to live with a Seth, a powerful businessman from Western India. He did not allow Durga to sell her own body. Instead, she used his money to buy girls who could not get enough to eat. Famine had brought into the market females of diverse classes and castes, some of whom would normally have been cherished as daughters or wives, and who could earn large profits for brothel owners. In the previous century, historian William Hunter had noted that famine boosted the slave trade. Infamous women went about buying up beautiful girls. In the old days, an upper-class prostitute, as Durga had once been, would hide her face behind a fold of her sari when first encountering a potential customer. Instead, she would display the heel of her foot, bordered with red paint and adorned with an anklet, so that a customer could judge her youth and class. As a madam, though, Durga dispensed with such niceties. If you didn't get undressed right away, she'd threaten to put a broken bottle up your insides, reported Kohinoor Begum, one of her former slaves. The madam would live into the 21st century, dying at the age of 103 and bequeathing cars, jewellery and 5 brothels to her sons. Women also sold sex of their own accord in order to provide for themselves and their families. Historians Christopher Bailey and Tim Harper have written that, unlike the Japanese and their comfort women, the British did not need to use overt coercion to provide entertainment for their soldiers. Free enterprise did it all for them. Officially sanctioned brothels enabled at least one enterprising military officer to put away a stash for retirement. During the 1943 famine, 10-year-old Monju Patro lived with her parents and 3 siblings in a 2-story mud house in a Midnapore village. She would line up her mug at a gruel kitchen, but sometimes it would remain empty. Her mother husked rice for a better-off family, bringing home for the children the broken rice she got in return, as well as the puffed rice they gave her for breakfast. "I never saw her eat," Patro said. A neighbour had been working on the girl for days, telling her that he would get her a job in a babu's home. "I didn't listen," Patro related, "but one day, while she was play-cooking with other children, using utensils, rice and vegetables they had fashioned out of mud, the man drew her aside and said, 'Come along, I'll buy you sweets at the train station.' The girl had eagerly assented. She was wearing her only dress, a pretty frock made of flannel. My father had given it to me for Durga Pujo, and her drawstring underpants. When they reached the railway station after a long trek, the man had bought her 2 or 3 rosogola, cheese balls in syrup. I was so absorbed in eating that I never realized he was putting me on the train," Patro recounted. Calcutta, which she had never seen before, had dumbfounded the young girl. The neighbor left her with a woman who gave the girl a roti, flat bread. I was thrilled to get to eat. Then she cried, wondering why the man was not coming back to take her home, but to no avail. She would spend the next years drawing water, sweeping, and mopping for the madam. After Monju menstruated, the madam said that she would arrange her marriage. "I still didn't understand," Patro recalled. "I was weeping because it didn't feel like a real wedding. Where were the guests, the music, the turmeric ceremony? She gave me something to drink, my head spun, and I went to sleep. When I woke up, I was paining all over. I couldn't get up. I never saw the man." Following that initial rape, she had been made to stand on the street wearing colourful print saris in front of 14 Maniktola Lane, an address that, judging by her precise and bitter enunciation of it 63 years later, was tattooed onto her brain. "I never understood who it was I serviced. They spoke all kinds of languages. I never saw the money. Life in the brothel had been a miasma of terror." Early one morning, Patro watched through a slit that served as her window as thugs in the lane below strangled a customer for his watch and wallet. Another time, a gangster forced his way in and, laying a sword on the bed between 2 women, raped them all night long. "We saw a prostitute cut up and stuffed into the gutter," Patro remembered. "Couldn't do anything." Patro eventually fled the madam, running off with a man who had fallen in love with her. She continued to sell her body because they needed the money. Her boyfriend was a chef, but after he broke a hand he could not earn much, so they had returned to Sonagachi, Calcutta's main red-light area and fetid slum, where they lived cheaply. Years after her children were grown, Patro complained that they neglected her. "One son is a cook and lives far away," she said. "He took everything I had." Patro still remembered the faces of her own parents, whom she had never seen again. "Where will I find them now?" Pushpo Otikari also came from Midnapore, but forgot the name of her village. At the famine time, she had been about 8. She had a brother and a sister, and her parents were old. My mother couldn't feed me, she remembered. If we ate in the morning, we couldn't eat in the evening. One day, while she was playing with other boys and girls, cooking up a banquet out of mud, a stranger, wearing a dhoti and vest, had approached them. He offered to find her work in a babu's house, where she would eat well and even earn money to send home to her parents. Pushpa was hungry. I said to him, I'll just run in and tell my mother. He replied, don't bother, I'll tell them later. As had happened to Monju Patro, the man had given her sweets at the train station, brought her to Calcutta, and sold her to a madam who had first made the girl work as a maid. After Pushpo menstruated, the madam put her in a room with a young man, left the door open a crack, and sat herself on a stool outside to intimidate the child into cooperating. After 4 years of prostitution, when I got smarter, Pushpo ran off. Not knowing any other trade, she continued to work the streets of Sonogachi. She fell in love with a chauffeur, but he would beat her when she did not give him her earnings. Otikari's son had died young. Her daughter had fortunately escaped prostitution by working as a maid in a rich household, so rich that they had security guards at the entrance. Speaking in old age of her own survival in the slums of Sonogachi, she said, I've spent my entire life in this hell. Both the orphanages and the brothel saved the lives of some thousands of the millions of children under 10 who suffered from the famine and represented almost half the refugees on Calcutta's streets. Stationed in a Bengali town that he did not name, Clive Branson went out one evening to buy underwear and to eat in a restaurant. The food was very good and the prices astonishingly low. But walking back along the streets, he heard someone sobbing her heart out and found a little girl lying on the edge of the pavement. He gave her a few coins and tried to speak to her. Some locals gathered, explaining matter-of-factly that she was one of the starving. At that, I lost my temper completely and told them that they should be bloody well ashamed to walk past a child in her state, he related. Branson made some of them carry her to a relief centre. The whole incident upset me so much that I cannot face going into the town again, because being in the army, I don't know what I can do to help these creatures. Another soldier, William A. Barnes, wrote in his diary, I have heard many homeless little children of between 5 and 10 crying bitterly and coughing terribly outside my room in the rest camp at Chittagong at 3 and 4 in the morning in the pouring monsoon rain. They were all stark naked, homeless, motherless, fatherless, and friendless. Their sole possession was an empty tin in which to collect scraps of food. We were strictly prohibited from helping any of these refugees in any way under heavy penalties. Many could not endure to see this suffering, though, and did help surreptitiously. Sergeant John Kraut recalled that famine sufferers surrounded his army camp because they were given the leftovers of military meals. A guard patrolled the edges of the camp to make sure any bodies were promptly removed. Once he was badly shaken by the sight of a girl, not yet dead, whose arm had been torn off and devoured by a jackal. Even battle-hardened soldiers were unnerved by such things, Kraut said. Unsettling sights and sounds were all too common. The Hindustan Standard reported on November 15, 1943, that a stranger had guided 3 nuns in Islampur in eastern Bengal to an abandoned stable by a riverside. There, to their utter horror, they found about 20 babies laid in rows on the dark and unclean floor of the stable. Some of the babies were crying in agony for food, some gasping for breath, and the rest in a state of utter exhaustion and stupor. On inquiry, they learned that the mothers of the babies, no longer able to carry them on their arms in their trek through the city in search of food, had left their dear little ones behind, hoping to return after the day's wanderings to their babies with food for them. The odds that a mother would make it back to her baby were slim. On November 21, a doctor described women at a gruel kitchen, also in eastern Bengal, mere skeletons covered simply with skins, some gasping for their last breath in my presence, mothers hugging their dying and dead children unable, having no strength, to weep or cry, some practically in delirium, calling for food, only to expire within minutes or hours of eating. In the third week of September, a temporary governor, Thomas Rutherford, arrived in Calcutta. "The scenes are pretty ghastly," he reported to Viceroy Linlithgow, but he added that native ministers were being obstructive about forcible removal to outside camps of hordes of destitutes in Calcutta. When he met the new governor, civil servant Olaf Martin was astonished to realize that he had no idea of the extent of the catastrophe. Rutherford insisted that only the few thousands who fouled the city streets were starving, whereas in fact they were just a symptom of the famine stalking almost all of Bengal's villages. Even after touring Midnapore, Rutherford assured Linlithgow that the majority of starving are the parasitic beggars and old people hitherto maintained by private charity. The new governor seemed to have believed the official line that ordinary cultivators were causing the shortages by withholding grain from the market. These secret hoards should have kept villagers from starving, he and other officials were convinced, so the dead and dying had to belong to a small and hopefully irrelevant section of the population. In truth, the worst of the hoarders were allies of the government. The administration in Bengal had issued 5,000 licenses for grain procurement, and licensees could store rice with impunity. As a result, Barnes complained, the big merchant, largely responsible in many instances for the slow and agonizing death of hundreds or thousands of his fellow countrymen, careened merrily on, unassailable and untouched, in mere virtue of his wealth and connections, cornering ever more wagon-loads of life-giving produce, holding up distribution, forcing up prices, securing more government contracts. And whereas natives hoarded, which was at least in principle a penal offence, white men stockpiled, which was not only legal but recommended. British business houses were advised to store at least a month's supply of rice for their labourers. One Mr. Parker, a merchant who served on Bengal's legislature, admitted to having kept much more than he needed. That autumn, parts of Bengal that had a perennial water supply harvested a minor crop of rice. The Famine Commission found that the Bengal administration purchased 370,000 mons of it in a central district, Jessore, and heaped it onto a railway platform there. The district magistrate, who was determined to preserve the stockpile, did not release any of the grain except for small quantities in October and November, 2,400 mons in December 1943, and about 12,000 mons in January and February 1944, the commission stated. That is, a tiny portion of the hoard was made available for famine relief, but only after the winter harvest, reaped in late December, had reduced the necessity for stocks. Some 90,000 tons of grain were also stored under tarpaulins in the Royal Botanical Gardens near Calcutta. Although it was pressed by legislators, the administration refused to yield its stores to the starving. In 1944, witnesses testifying before the Famine Commission charged that part of the rice secreted by district officials had rotted and was being surreptitiously disposed of. According to contemporary accounts, the public was allowed to scavenge from the government's dumps, such as the one in the botanical gardens, only after much of the contents had decayed. Rumours also abounded of the police and military having thrown rotted rice into canals. For more than a year, Asok Mitra, the civil servant in charge of Munshi Ganj in eastern Bengal, had watched the suffering increase. In August 1943, he sensed that the people were finally collapsing under the strain of starvation. Of the people I saw on the streets, more than half had blank looks, their faces and eyes were shrunken, and their skin stuck to their bones like paper. They took a long time just to focus their eyes. Their joints poked out, and the hair on their bodies stood straight up, Mitra wrote, like big black pins. This marker of terminal starvation, sometimes described as growth of fur, was also noted in previous Indian famines and in the Irish famine. In late September, Mitra heard that the government in Calcutta was making some of its stocks available for famine relief, and he visited the district magistrate in Dhaka to see if he could get any. By the stately stairway of his superior's office, he found a giant signboard, one side of which announced that the sahib would be in between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m., but would not see anyone, and the other side of which stated that he would not be in at all. Mitra finally located the district magistrate at a club, pouring himself a second pink gin before lunch. He graciously offered his subordinate a drink, but refused to discuss rice. Mitra was subsequently able to obtain rice through a military officer. When it arrived from Calcutta, it was half rotted and gritty with gravel, but food nonetheless, and by October 20 he had opened 100 gruel kitchens all over Munsi Gunj. At first, the kitchens provided just soft-boiled rice and fayan, but later they began to offer a nourishing mixture of rice, lentils, and bits of potato or squash, flavoured with salt, turmeric, bay leaf, and a little oil. The starving would fall upon this kichichuri, eat their fill, and swell up like balloons, their arms and legs as translucent as the whites of uncooked eggs. Their bodies having partially consumed their cell walls, the fluids they ingested had flowed into the spaces between the cells. If you saw the thrill in their eyes, you couldn't scold them for eating too much, Mitra said. The mixture would hasten their demise, but he felt death was inevitable for them at such a late stage of starvation. That they got some tasty food before they died was some comfort to me. Most of those who perished in this manner were women and children. The men, he believed, had already died. At the turn of the 18th century, the Marquess of Wellesley, Governor-General of India, had ordered the construction of a residence grand enough for the ruler of the vast possession. The palace, built in a Greco-Roman style and surrounded by more than 20 acres of gardens, served as the seat of the British Raj for more than a century. 12 white marble busts of Roman emperors, including those of Nero and Caligula, adorned its spacious public hall. Calcutta had long ceased to be the capital of India, but the governor's residence was still the wellspring of imperial power in Bengal. An Englishwoman said that while driving past the edifice during the famine, she saw that someone had laid the dead and the half-dead along the walls, so that they formed a circle around the kilometre-long perimeter of the palace. The wreath of corpses marked the passing of empire. Chapter 9. Run, Rabbit, Run. In late August 1943, the mayor of Calcutta cabled to President Roosevelt, appealing to him and to Churchill for grain shipments in the name of starving humanity. The President and the Prime Minister were in conference at Quebec, Canada. Churchill also received messages from the Viceroy, which were seconded by the Commander-in-Chief in India, warning that the paucity of wheat shipments threatened all operations based in the colony. The Secretary of State for India, for his part, continued to contend with the War Cabinet for grain for the remainder of that summer, as well as through the fall and the winter. At Quebec, the Allies agreed to create a collaborative military structure based in India, the Southeast Asia Command, or SEAC, in anticipation of an overland thrust into Burma in 1944. The forces in India were to be supplemented with troops and equipment that could be airdropped into the dense jungle of the East Himalayan foothills, and these preparations for war would further strain the Indian economy. Churchill went on from Quebec to stay at the White House for about 10 days, with a break for a lecture at Harvard, but whether or not he discussed the Bengal famine with Roosevelt is unknown. On August 23, Amory informed Leathers that the U.S. consulate in Calcutta had offered to help buy wheat in America and transport it to Bengal. The consulate had added that shipping for 20,000 tons or so should not present serious difficulty. Amory asked Leathers, who was at the Quebec conference, to follow up on the offer with his American counterparts, but the minister had other views. There is no wheat to spare on the east coast of North America, a Ministry of War Transport paper noted, owing to inland transportation difficulties. Wheat might be bought on the west coast, but shipping from there was not straightforward. There seems, therefore, little to be gained from this proposal, British officials concluded. Notwithstanding such reluctance, two U.S. military ships were loaded with 5,000 tons of Canadian wheat the following month for transport to India. News of the Bengal famine broke in American newspapers at this time, but was buried in inside pages, whereas the popular Prime Minister's visit filled the front pages. By then, the United Kingdom had won American hearts. The spreading of Enlightenment, as the British called their propaganda in the United States, had been assiduous, with careful attention paid to answering any U.S. criticism of British policies. For instance, when Ambassador Phillips met with a group of Harvard intellectuals and told them that democracy in India was no more than a kind of modern frosting of the old imperial cake, a British agent took notes. These were passed to a supposedly independent Indian journalist who was to address the same gathering so that he could counter the specific points that Phillips had raised. The U.S. State Department was, however, receiving its own reports on the condition of Calcutta's pavements. According to historian M.S. Venkataramani, on August 30, a concerned official asked the Combined Food Board, the Anglo-American agency that allocated supplies, to set aside some rice for Bengal. The British representative on the board protested that wheat was available in Australia and, after checking with London, reported that the government of India was coping with the situation. He insisted that His Majesty's government alone would provide information on the famine, and he did not permit the Food Board to hear a representative from the government of India's supply mission to the United States. When a serious famine developed in Bengal in 1943, we made efforts to secure from the all-too-inadequate rice stocks in the Western Hemisphere an allocation of rice for India, Secretary of State Cordell Hull would write in his memoirs. The British representatives on the Combined Food Board in Washington insisted, however, that the responsibility for Indian food requirements be left to Britain, and we perforce had to agree. Another U.S. agency, the Board of Economic Warfare, asked the War Shipping Administration, which was responsible for allocating shipping space to diverse American authorities, if some grain could be loaded onto the vessels departing for India with military stores. American soldiers in the colony were getting certain food, such as canned meat, from home, but for wheat and rice they relied on local supplies. The shipping officials had, however, come to resent the amount of tonnage that the United Kingdom had already obtained for its domestic import program. It was up to the British to make more ships available, they replied, and if the U.S. military could find space to spare for grain, it must be in possession of more ships than it needed, in which case some would be taken away. American generals, for their part, had long been irritated by what they saw as British foot-dragging in the war against Japan. After instituting the January 1943 shipping cutback to the Indian Ocean, the British had approached the Americans with a request for 113 sailings to India, from the United States or the United Kingdom, to carry equipment for the Anakim military campaign and supplies for civilians. Subsequently, however, the British had been willing to forgo that shipping in lieu of a firm commitment of additional vessels for their domestic import program. So American General Brown B. Somerville had found himself pushing for a shipping allotment to India that the British themselves seemed to have lost interest in. On top of that, U.S. commanders entertained an open suspicion that a significant portion of the materials that the British had originally requested was intended for troops who would fight not the Japanese but the Indians. Americans were adamant that they would not help rebuild the British Empire. Yet whether the troops in India fought Indians or Japanese, they would have to eat, and if they did not get supplies from outside, then they would feed off the people. William Phillips, who was still the president's representative to India, was upset with his superior's inaction on the colony's affairs. He argued in September that the combination of British-Indian political deadlock and Bengal famine would destroy American credibility in India, and he urged the president to take steps to break the stalemate and feed the starving. Nothing came of it. Meanwhile, an intelligence summary from Chittagong, the base for the upcoming jungle war, warned that soldiers were so distressed by the famine that they were feeding beggars with their own rations, even though they are disobeying orders by so doing. Whether they were British or Indian, soldiers generally believed that the government had fallen down on its responsibilities. Recognizing the discontent in the ranks, the military leadership took up the challenge of advocating to the Prime Minister for increased grain shipments. On September 8, 1943, General Auchinleck wrote to the Chief of the Imperial General Staff, Field Marshal Alan Brooke, asking him to use his influence. The Chiefs of Staff obliged with a memo to the War Cabinet. The situation was so grave as to threaten the prosecution of war against Japan, they asserted, and only grain imports could resolve the crisis. Amory supported their appeal by adding that, in the light of the Cabinet decision, precisely which decision is unclear, American offers of rice and wheat had had to be discouraged, but the situation in Bengal provided a very dangerous handle to Japanese propaganda of which full use is being made. An apparent reference to the offers of rice from Bose. The day before the War Cabinet was to discuss the Bengal famine for the second time, Lord Chirwell sent a memo to the Prime Minister, who had just returned from Washington. Once again, the prof expressed incredulity that 500,000 tons, which the government of India wanted by year-end, could make any difference. But if conditions are really as bad as we are told, it might be well, in view of the easier shipping position, to increase the loadings of grain for the time being, he suggested. Such shipments should only continue, he added, if provincial governments disgorged their supplies. Tom Wilson, the S branch researcher for Indian matters, pointed out to Chirwell that although 500,000 tons of imports were indeed a small amount compared to the total crop of India, this broad statistical comparison of orders of magnitudes is likely to be seriously misleading. The harvest was unevenly distributed, as would be the relief, so weighing the total crop against the quantity of relief yielded a ratio with no relevance to reality. Since the deficit of grain was concentrated in certain locales, even the modest relief requested could substantially check the famine. By the time the War Cabinet revisited the issue of the famine, on September 24, 1943, Amory had obtained permission for the 50,000 tons of wheat mentioned on August 4 to go to India rather than to Ceylon. The first consignment could be loaded no earlier than October, and since the journey from Australia took a month, it must have arrived in India in November. The 5,000 tons of Canadian wheat must also have reached the colony in November and was counted as part of the 50,000 tons. At the meeting, Field Marshal Wavell, soon to be the Viceroy of India, said that rations for the Indian Army had had to be cut earlier in 1943 while he was Commander-in-Chief, and the current situation looked much worse than it did then. According to the minutes, Leathers responded that it was now too late to relieve the famine. Although more ships were available to the British Empire, it would not be possible to work additional ships into positions from which they could lift grain for delivery in India before the next Indian harvest. The most that he could manage before year-end was 30,000 tons of barley a month from the Balkan stockpile and 30,000 tons of wheat that were to have been sent to the Middle East but were no longer needed. The members of the War Cabinet decided, however, that Balkan stocks should not be drawn down unduly. That meant they felt no more than 50,000 tons of wheat and barley could be spared, in addition to the 150,000 tons promised earlier, which were still being processed. After the standing orders for Ceylon and the Middle East, as well as the diversions to India, were met, up to 6 ships surplus to these requirements would present for loading at Australia in November. These would continue to transport wheat to the Balkan stockpile. Again, Amory's diaries provide an angry insight into the motives behind the proceedings. "I fought my battle for Indian food as hard as I could," he wrote. "Winston was prepared to admit that something should be done, but very strong on the point that Indians are not the only people who are starving in this war, and that as far as the war goes, it is just as important to get food to Greece." Winston may be right in saying that the starvation of anyhow underfed Bengalis is less serious than sturdy Greeks, but he makes no sufficient allowance for the sense of empire responsibility in this country. Wavell's account is just as revealing. "Apparently, it is more important to save the Greeks and liberated countries from starvation than the Indians, and there is reluctance either to provide shipping or to reduce stocks in this country." Wavell offers the only hint that there was a discussion of supplying Bengal or southern Europe from the United Kingdom's import program. "I pointed out military considerations and that practically the whole of India outside the rural districts was more or less engaged on war effort, and that it was impossible to differentiate and feed only those actually fighting or making munitions or working some particular railways, as PM had suggested." At the Quebec conference, the Americans had firmly rejected a plan for an invasion of the Balkans, and Churchill did not have the military resources necessary to pursue the venture alone. That rebuff had done nothing to dull his enthusiasm for the project. According to Field Marshal Brooke, the Prime Minister hated having to give up the position of the dominant partner which we had held at the start, and which the United States was inexorably assuming. As a result, he became inclined at times to put up strategic proposals which he knew were unsound, purely to spite the Americans. The humiliation inflicted by multiple British defeats at Japanese and German hands must also have rankled him, leading Churchill to hold in the back of his mind the desire to form a purely British theatre when the laurels would be all ours. The Balkans still held out hope for being such a front. In October, at a send-off dinner for Wavell, now elevated to the peerage to befit the vice-royalty he was about to assume, Churchill gave a speech on India. "When we look back over the course of years, we see one part of the world's surface where there has been no war for 3 generations," he declaimed. "Famines have passed away, until the horrors of war and the dislocations of war have given us a taste of them again, and pestilence has gone." To his profound sorrow, these accomplishments were not appreciated. "It was thought in many parts of the world that all we did was to sit on the top of India, exploiting the poor, unfortunate people, and taking away their hard-earned sustenance in order to enrich ourselves. But should the day come, as I pray it may not, when we cast down for ever our responsibilities there and vanish from the scene, this episode in Indian history will surely become the golden age as time passes, when the British gave them peace and order, and there was justice for the poor, and all men were shielded from outside dangers. The golden age." Lord Wavell, a quiet man of firm convictions, had spent several frustrating months trying to get the War Cabinet to endorse some fresh political proposal so that he would not arrive in India empty-handed. He rose to respond. According to Amory, he directly challenged Winston's whole position by indicating that his own goal was a self-governing India. The War Cabinet subsequently discussed Wavell's proposal, which was to invite 10 Indian leaders, including Gandhi and Jinnah, for discussions on the country's future. Winston let himself go in a longish and pretty strong harangue, getting warmed up towards the end in an eloquent but irrelevant discourse on the worthlessness and probable disloyalty of India's large and well-equipped army, recorded Amory. As for Wavell, He grimly concluded that some face-saving formula would finally emerge from the War Cabinet discussions, designed to carry them on and get me out there, but with every intention of blocking any progress. The more I see of politicians, the less I respect them. The next day, Amory and Wavell perused a document that Churchill had drafted on India. Peace, order, and a high condition of wartime well-being were essential for the eventual thrust against Japan, it noted. Every effort must be made, even by the diversion of shipping urgently needed for war purposes, to deal with local shortages. The Viceroy must ensure fairer distribution of resources, restore peace between Hindu and Muslim, and move toward self-government. "You are wafted to India on a wave of hot air," Wavell wrote that Amory told him. Amory would remember the wave as a gentle breeze. When the Viceroy-designate went to bid farewell to the Prime Minister, Churchill was menacing and unpleasant. He indicated that only over his dead body would any approach to Gandhi take place, Wavell recorded in his diary. Despite the sentiments he had put on paper, Churchill remained determined to stop any political advance in India. Viceroy Linlithgow, writing from Simla, the picturesque summer retreat of the colonial government, dispatched a valedictory letter to the Secretary of State for India. "I can feel as I lay down this great charge that I leave the country in pretty good trim," he summed up. "The leaders of Congress were in jail and forgotten, and Gandhi is equally out of the way of doing mischief." Linlithgow's only unresolved concerns were inflation and the food position. A communication from Bengal's governor observed, however, that the famine does not constitute grave menace to peace or tranquillity of Bengal or any part thereof, for sufferers are entirely submissive and emergency threatens, not maintenance of law and order, but preservation of public health and economic stability. Meanwhile, Lady Linlithgow had written to the Prime Minister requesting an American Liberator bomber in which to fly home, because it had twice the capacity of the one that had been assigned to her and the outgoing Viceroy. "Having endured 7.5 very strenuous years in India," she wrote, "I would like to be rewarded by a free trip home in this Liberator, in which we can take quite a lot of luggage." Churchill obliged, sending Wavell and other officers out in 2 civilian aircraft that would bring back the former Viceroy and his wife. Arriving in New Delhi on October 18, 1943, the new Viceroy received a roundup of the colony's affairs from the departing one. "No progress was possible until Gandhi died," Linlithgow advised, "and in any case, India would take 30 years to learn how to govern itself." As for the famine, it could have been worse. Back in July, Linlithgow had anticipated a death toll of up to 1.5 million, "but we looked like getting off better than he had thought possible," Wavell recorded. Days later, Viceroy Wavell flew to Bengal and gauged that the situation was out of control. Ever since the Statesman had publicized the famine, wheat from the Punjab had been pouring into Calcutta, but it was still only enough for the city itself. Gruel kitchens had been opened in the rural districts, but "we simply have not the food to give the portions prescribed by the famine code," the governor noted. Wavell mobilized the hitherto idle army to distribute relief and conduct vaccinations, an invaluable contribution given that the military possessed the organization, the transport, the medical and other officers, and the pent-up energy that Bengal badly needed. Still, the army would need something to distribute. "This is now definitely a military as well as a charity problem, since army must have a stable base," Wavell explained to Amory. "Please impress upon War Cabinet that in my view situation is most serious, and that if confidence is to be restored, maximum possible imports of food grains against Government of India demand must be arranged." But the famine had failed to temper the Prime Minister's fury with Indians. That October, apropos of nothing except some stuff which that wretched Churwell had been pouring into his ears, Churchill exploded again on the subject of these monstrous debts which we were incurring to India for no value received, and for the piling up of a useless and unreliable army in India itself, wrote Amory. In early November, he drove with Churchill to a concert at Harrow, and on the way they talked about the colony. The Prime Minister reiterated that he would resist any move toward Indian self-government as long as he lived. Amory told him that the House of Commons was unanimous that we should send more help from here for the famine. Churchill retorted that he did not care what the House thought in this matter. The thing was to win the war. The United Kingdom was releasing 500 tons of condensed milk from its stockpile. Field Marshal William Slim of the Indian Army would subsequently receive for his troops battered, rusted tins of milk, only half of which were still usable. The cans, he wrote, had been turned over from the United Kingdom stockpile and replaced with fresh cans from the United States. Churchill did express sympathy to Amory for having to bear all the kicks. The Secretary of State for India had to explain the famine to the politicians and public of the United Kingdom, and it was not easy. Speaking in various forums, Amory placed responsibility for the calamity on Indians, for overpopulation, hoarding, and misgovernment, the United Nations, which controlled shipping, and the Almighty, for crop failure. His correspondence and diaries make it clear, however, that Amory saw the famine as a straightforward consequence of the war effort. The real question, of course, is whether a poor country like India could ever have afforded, over and above what it has been asked to do for its own defence, to pay for its forces overseas and give as free lease-lend all the materials which we have bought from India during the war, he wrote to the head of the Indian Inflation Committee. Famine and sterling debt were two sides of the same coin, the exhaustive use of Indian resources for the war. Ever since Japan had reached the border, vast quantities of cash had had to be spent on military construction and provisions, explained a financial adviser to army commanders in India. Added to this, the shortage of world shipping grew more and more acute. Our Far Eastern sources of supply of rice were lost, and imports into India of consumer goods for the civil population were reduced to a comparative trickle. So more and more money was being poured into the pockets of all classes of consumers, but the goods on which they could spend their money were dwindling away, because civil stocks were being exhausted without further imports, and military demands, both for India and overseas, were taking a larger cut of the cake. The government of India could not borrow or tax enough money, and so had printed it, causing the prices of already scarce essentials to explode. Since the war began, the colony's expenditure on it had escalated by more than 10 times, from £40.2 million in the fiscal year that ended in March 1940 to £429.9 million in the fiscal year that ended in March 1943. Roughly half of this outlay accrued to the United Kingdom's sterling debt, which, too, was rising steeply. In my view, the Indians have got themselves into a mess very largely through their own fault, but no one can deny that they have obtained in return for their current sacrifices altogether exorbitant sterling balances, Churwell complained. To his mind, inflation, famine, and the sterling debt were all the fault of the Indians, as he had taken to calling officials of the Government of India, despite the fact that its upper echelons were almost entirely British. He may have been echoing Churchill's charge that everyone who goes to India or the India office becomes more anti-English than the Indians, a reference to Linlithgow and possibly Amory. The suggestion that the officials here have used their position as agents of His Majesty's government with an eye to India's interests only has caused intense resentment, Wavell would protest to Amory. To the best of my belief, there is no foundation whatever for this suggestion, and I hope you will be able to scotch it. For a British official in India to faithfully serve those who paid his salary would have been for him to betray his patriotic duty to his homeland. Lord Chirwell, despaired that his imperial nation was losing its instinct of self-preservation and becoming too generous. The financial agreement with India was most unfair to us, he declared. India was not, for instance, being charged for certain military equipment that was sent from abroad, and whereas the United Kingdom paid for the early training of most of the native troops fighting in the Middle East and Africa, the colony was paying for British troops only while they were in India and not while they had trained in the UK. In August 1943, India was hosting 200,000 British soldiers. It had also paid for the training of 60,000 British troops in the years leading up to the war. In one memo, the prof argued that the war in Libya was part and parcel of the defence of India, which should bear more of the cost of it. Nothing will convince me that even under this one-sided agreement we have had value for our money, he wrote. The Indians, he believed, had contrived to make excessive profit at our expense. Poring over the colony's accounts, the S branch discovered what it termed a scandal. Early in the war, the colony had charged the United Kingdom customs duties on petrol sent for the army. As it turned out, the government of India employed only 17 cost accountants, as opposed to 200 at the UK's Ministry of Supply alone, who had made a further mistake. They had placed on India's bill the petrol imported up until March 1942, which, according to the financial agreement, should have accrued to Britons. If that problem were also accounted for, the United Kingdom would owe the colony twice as much as it would get out of rectifying the customs error. So the government of India suggested ignoring both mistakes. The S branch got the last word, however. It found that the reimbursement India demanded for petrol was much too high, which was the fault not of the Indians, but of officials in London who had neglected to negotiate the price with sellers in the Middle East. The United Kingdom ended up repaying India only £5 million per year for the petrol instead of the £25 million per year that the colony claimed it was owed. The upshot, as Chirwell's assistant, Thomas Wilson, triumphantly put it, was that the S branch paid for itself with a handsome margin to spare. The Inflation Committee observed that the evidence does not, in our view, sustain a general conclusion that HMG has not had value for money. Even so, the United Kingdom should repudiate the debt to India, urged the prof. Innumerable ways can, of course, be devised of wrapping up the brute fact that we cannot and will not pay the sums in question. One was to forcibly alter the exchange rate between the rupee and the pound. The possibility of just such a post-war devaluation of the rupee had aggravated the Bengal famine by making Punjabi peasants reluctant to exchange their grain for cash. At the very least, Chirwell declared, India should bear the entire cost of the forthcoming campaign in Burma and Malaya. The colony would anyhow have to pay for the time being, Wilson pointed out in a paper drafted on behalf of Lord Chirwell. And whether or not the United Kingdom chose to reimburse any part of the cost in the distant future could make little difference to wartime inflation. Famine and debt collided yet again on November 10, 1943, when Amory used Wavell's report on Bengal to schedule a third War Cabinet discussion on relief. Bengal's winter harvest of rice would not reach the market